Stay tuned for The Turning Point. Space may be the place. There was a couple of articles in the paper this past week. One was Landing on a Comet, a Mission Aims to Unlock the Mysteries of Earth. In a technological feat that gives scientists their first opportunity to dig into a remnant of the early solar system, the European Space Agency's Rosetta mission successfully placed a small spacecraft on the surface of a speeding comet Wednesday. So all these movies that you see that are science fiction slowly but surely, you know, always come true, inevitably come true until we maybe end the planet before they're able to. But the technology of landing on a comet with its wisps of gravity could be applied to future efforts to mine asteroids. So that's one thing they're thinking of, is mining asteroids. Wasn't there a movie called Outland or Outlands? It's about mining. There is some giant mining company that that mines asteroids in space for various minerals that we used up here or new minerals that were discovered. Anyhow, for scientists, this is a project that's been going on for a couple of decades, and certainly intensely for the last several years. And so they landed on a comet. The European Space Technology Group, which is a combination of various countries, landed on a comet. They landed a vehicle on a comet, hopefully to send back data on what the comet is made of, where it comes from, what it is. For scientists, one of the central mysteries that Rosetta will explore is whether Earth's oceans are filled with melted comets. Since the rocky bits that came together to form the planet, sounds like Monty Python, since the rocky bits that came together to form the planet were dry, water has to come from somewhere else, right? It has to come from somewhere. It was all dry originally, according to this. But that's not what the Bible says, but that's a different kind of way of looking at the universe. One possibility is that comets slamming into the Earth seeded it with water, so they may discover where all the oceans came from. Comets are frozen leftovers from the formation of the solar system. So by, you know, boring into the center of the comet, well, into the surface of the comet as far as they can, and to, you know, to tap some of the information and send it back, if their vehicle is capable of doing that, which they hope, they can get some idea about how the solar system was formed, which is very, very, very fascinating is a euphemism. I mean, there's no word to describe how absolutely starkly, obsessively interesting this is to some people, how the universe, how the solar system was formed. And hopefully, if you learn how something happened in the past, it's the same thing with any kind of discovery of, you know, of anything personal, or if you want to invent or discover some kind of new new thing in the world, it's good to look back into what came before so that you can move forward. Otherwise, you're not moving forward on any kind of firm foundation. And the same thing happens with, you know, psychology. Scientists hope that that spacecraft's observations will offer important clues as to how the solar system came together 4.5 billion years ago. So that's what they're hoping for with this. I never had this curiosity. I never had this curiosity, but of course I am afraid of everything anyhow, and always was. So I am not the kind of person who would be fascinated by going where no man has gone before. Usually I've stayed where every man has stayed before. I have not gone where no man has gone before. But there are people, scientists, people who are, and people, not scientists, people who are absolutely fascinated, but how did the solar system get formed? I guess I'm interested in that too. When I was in school, when I was in high school, when I was in junior high school, I guess I was fascinated by that. And I remember at that age, a lot of projects were made about, and books were written, and we read textbooks about how was the Earth created. This is in the age of science, right? Before the age of creationism dawned on America. Then you don't have to worry about how it was formed, because it's very clear how it was formed. It says so on page whatever, you know, page 3 or 4 in Genesis. It says exactly how the Earth was formed. Or is it page 1? In the beginning was nothing, and then the big guy came and he made everything out of it. But if you don't believe that, you've got to find out other ways that the solar system, that the Earth, that the heavens, that space, how is it all formed? The other planets, the other, you know, the other heavenly bodies. Now, there was another article. Some of you may have read this. Sorry, I got a little post-nasal drip here. This is they turned the heat on in New York sometime in mid to late October, and it turns every apartment into kind of an oven, even if you turn the radiators off. And so the air becomes very, very heated and dries everybody out. So there is a mass rush to buy humidifiers. I guess that happens all over the place, but if you live in an apartment building, that's especially true. Because it dries out your nasal tract and your throat. Anyhow, you may have read about this. I don't know if you did or not, but there is a project that is being developed. I think it's by the head of Virgin Airways. What's his name? Virgin Galactic's Spaceship 2 is a rocket-powered vehicle designed to take well-heeled tourists to the edge of space. Anyhow, and this is... What happened was that one of these test rockets, which is supposed to take people who want to pay at least $250,000 to the edge of space and presumably say that they did it, or to take photographs or whatever, one of these rockets crashed out in the Mojave Desert. I don't know. It crashed, let's see, rocket-powered vehicle designed to take... crashed on a flight over the Mojave Desert, killing one test pilot and seriously injuring the other. And then there was another explosion in 2007 during a rocket fuel test that killed three employees on the ground at the Mojave Air and Space Port. Now, a lot, the initial reaction you have, of course, is that that's terrible. What a tragedy, right? On the other hand, then you start thinking, well, what are these people doing, risking their lives, literally, risking their lives, and in some cases here, losing them, so that a bunch of extremely rich people can take a kind of a thrill flight up into space? There's not enough poverty in the world that needs to be relieved. There's not enough science that involves the Earth itself and how to save the Earth that needs to be invested in. That these people have so much extra money that they can do that. And, you know, there are apparently hundreds and hundreds of people who have signed up for this. So so he says in this op-ed article here, he says, these sacrifices were not just tragic for many people. There was something needless or even obscene about them. Brave men are dead in the service of a for-profit venture in which a bunch of thrill-seeking billionaires and Hollywood A-listers have plunked down deposits up to the full $250,000 cost for a ticket to slip the surly bonds. That's poetic. To slip the surly bonds, presumably of gravity, for several minutes of a floating weightlessness and trophy photography 62 miles above the Earth. But he's not condemning this, actually. He's applauding this venture that is going to take people to the edge of space for, you know, this huge amount of money. for some whose job it was to make that happen, this was truly a view to die for. But then he goes on to say, whether or not Friday's crash was preventable, it was far from pointless. It is worth considering that to a striking degree, the criticism of space tourism today echoes the scoffing of a century ago that greeted the arrival of powered flight. Certainly the Wright brothers and others of early pioneers of flight were involved in what we now view as an epic quest. But many experts of the day were certain that flight, however interesting, was destined to be not much more than a rich man's hobby with no practical value. And so if these people did not risk their lives doing something which everybody thought was a waste of time and it was only for rich people, a hobby for rich people, which it was in the very beginning, the first commercial flights, you had to have a lot of money to fly in. He's comparing these two things and saying, let's see, the public has greatly here's a quote from somebody at the time of the flight of the Wright brothers. The public has greatly overestimated the possibilities of the aeroplane, spelled A-E-R-O-P-L-A-N-E, imagining that in another generation they will be able to fly over to London in a day, said a Harvard expert in 1908. This is manifestly impossible. Two other professors patiently explained that while laymen may think that because a machine will carry two people, another may be constructed that will carry a dozen. Couldn't happen. In fact, those who make this contention do not understand the theory of weight sustentation in the air. Well, see? And this man, his name is Sam Howe Verhovic, who wrote this op-ed piece. He says, in recent years, I have interviewed a wide array of people involved in the private space industry, including both pilots involved in the crash on Friday. So he knew one of the ones who died. Almost universally, they viewed themselves as pioneers at the dawn of an era of exploration whose apogee is beyond our generation's imagination. Just as the Wright brothers did not have a precise image in mind of a jumbo jetliner ferrying people around the world so routinely and so safely at more than 500 miles per hour that we have long stopped considering it a miracle, we can't really know where we're headed in space. But, they insist, the people involved in this project, we certainly need to go there. I think it is actually very important, said one of them, that we start making progress in extending life beyond Earth. Extending life beyond Earth, and we start making our own experience a multi-planetary one. A multi-planetary one. Elon Musk, the founder of SpaceX, whose goal is to enable people to live on other planets, once told me, that is the writer here, he called the venture a giant insurance policy for the survival of our species. Well, I mean, that implies, of course, that our species is not going, is probably, their insurance is a bet that something's going to work or not work. What he's implying here, Mr. Musk, who's another rich man, I forget where he gets his money from, that this place is going to be used up, uninhabitable by all human beings, if not every other form of life. And as we can see, that is clearly starting to happen. So basically, this company called SpaceX that Mr. Musk formed says that their goal is to build up or find planets where people can survive, because it sounds like he believes that sooner or later, and maybe too soon, people are not going to be able to survive on this planet. And it is already happening, obviously. let's see. Seen in this light, the first round of space tourism is simply seed capital for something much grander. It's possible that tomorrow's budget-minded space travelers will thank today's one percenters, just as you can credit early adopters of expensive behemoth mainframe computers for your 250 desktop. One could argue, of course, that space tourism is more grandiose than grand. After all, one of the enduring ironies of the initial space age is that we spent all those billions of dollars to produce, among other things, magnificent and iconic remote photographs of Earth that fired the environmental movement to focus on protecting our lonely, beautiful, fragile island of a planet. And in other words, there were benefits to all the billions of dollars spent by the United States government and other governments on sending astronauts into space and to space exploration. What did we get out of it? I mean, he believes in this, in other words. He says it's not, we shouldn't condemn this as just some rich man's hobby that's going to go nowhere, that it's a hopeless venture. But it all depends who is planning to get what out of this. I mean, last week I was talking about Wernher von Braun, whose lifelong dream was to go into space. Since he was a teenager, he wanted to go into space. And maybe for human beings, it was a kind of a universal ancient dream. I don't know about the mythology of every land or every country or the talk or whatever writing there is in every country about exploring space. About what is there? What are all those bright lights up there? Why does the moon do this? Why does the sun do that? I mean, all like mythology is based on this. The moon, the sun. This universal desire to figure out where we came from, there's a void out there. And maybe there was always a universal desire. And is there still in people? I don't know. I mean, do we take it for granted now that we've got a space station and we've got astronauts always going back and forth, this country and other countries? What is being done up there? Why do we spend all that money to go up there? Especially, why do we spend all that money? And Wernher von Braun, who I spoke about last week, who was the chief Nazi rocket scientist who came to the United States, who was brought to the United States after World War II, was ultimately in charge of the rocket ship that took men to walk on the moon. So, he is considered the father of all this kind of stuff. And my father was a chemical engineer. My father was a scientist, and he only had one kind of reading matter that he liked, and that was science fiction. He didn't like fantasy too much, but he loved science fiction with the emphasis on the science. And like a lot of people like that, and millions and millions and millions of people, he, mostly men that I knew of, actually, he was fascinated by the idea of exploring space, space, the final frontier, what's out there. And it wasn't so much, or was it? I don't know. I mean, you know, unfortunately, I didn't know my father that well, but I know he was absolutely fascinated by this, whereas I wasn't. I mean, he was the kind of person who would take chances anyhow. My father was a chance taker. I mean, he drove 100 miles an hour around, you know, mountain passes. he flew in rickety planes that he shouldn't have. Ultimately, he died in one that crashed. He was he would go out on the ocean on a stormy day for a trip or to go fishing or something like that. He took chances. He took physical chances. And if he had been young when the time came for the astronauts to be trained, I'm sure he would have volunteered for it. He was in pretty good shape. He had some problems, but he could have volunteered to be an astronaut, I suppose, although he didn't have any flying experience. But he and I used to have these conversations about it. Mostly I would just listen, and I wasn't going to be cynical with him about it. Later on, I suppose I was a little cynical. Let's see. My father died several years after we successfully went into space and successfully walked on the moon. And I say we, I mean they. I never felt like I was part of that, but, you know, still it was fascinating. I mean, I don't know, you would have to be a certain age. You see, 1969, that's quick, 31, 45 years ago. So you would have to be, what, 50 plus and up to have actually witnessed this. Not personally, of course. I mean, you didn't go up there and walk on the moon. But the whole world that was capable of watching this, and certainly it seemed like everybody in the United States, and I still have an old newspaper somewhere in my closet somewhere, and everybody saved these newspapers, and it said, I think it was the Times, it said, "Men walk on moon. Men walk on moon." It was one of the most extraordinary things that anybody had ever witnessed, and TV, of course, was a miracle that brought it to you. And I remember where I was, and it was in April, I think, April of 1969 that it was, or was it, was it in the summer? Maybe it was in the summer of 1969 that that Neil Armstrong, and it was essential and it was important back in the day. It wouldn't happen now. Now it would be a special ops or a SEAL who would walk on the moon first. But in those days, they went to a lot of trouble. They had military people in the spacecraft and in the module, whatever it was called, that landed on the moon. I think they were capable of putting anybody on there, obviously. But they picked a civilian. They picked one of the few civilians in the space program to walk on the moon. And that was a difference in the United States back in those days compared to now. Now everything is military, military, military. It's Military Appreciation Month. It's Military Valor and Appreciation, you know, day and year. Every sports event you see, it's supposed to be Military Appreciation Time. And if they put somebody on the moon now, you can bet it would be somebody who was a trained, military man or military woman. But in those days, to show that it was still a democracy, and I'm putting motives into the planning of the people who did this, I don't really know, but maybe there are articles about it. They chose a civilian to be the first person to walk on the moon. And he uttered the famous words, in my paraphrasing here, I guess, that is, he took a step onto the moon. He says, that's one small step for man and one giant leap for mankind. Was it really? Was it really a giant leap for mankind? This is what they would like to believe. And maybe one day it will be. I don't really know. But there is this kind of fascination with space. And, I mean, imagine landing on the moon. And we were all fascinated. I was in my early 20s then. Let's see, how old was I? I was 24 when men walked on the moon. And I remember sitting in my friend Tommy's apartment, this guy I worked with at the welfare department in Williamsburg. He, Italian guy, really sweet guy, good-hearted guy. He was sick for a week. He had a really bad flu, and he was just about over it. But he was, you know, sitting around. He lived by himself. And I went over to visit him and brought him some flowers. He liked flowers. So I gave him some. He used to buy flowers every Friday. He was a very sweet guy, this guy Tommy. So I brought him some flowers, and he put them in a vase. And we sat there and watched along with tens, maybe hundreds of millions of other people all over the world as Neil Armstrong landed on the moon and walked on the moon. I guess the camera was set up. I don't know how the camera was set up. I mean, you know, there is actually a conspiracy theory that abounds that is very prominent out in the world and started like right afterwards that they never did walk on the moon. That all the money that NASA got to do this was channeled into something else, and men never did walk on the moon. That the whole thing was filmed in a television studio somewhere out in the desert in New Mexico or Arizona. There are people who believe that this never really happened. So I don't know. I really don't know. But now it would be definitely a military thing. And in those days, there was something. It wasn't just pure exploration. It wasn't just pure curiosity. It was also military too. I remember, and in the Russians, we were racing the Russians into space and presumably to the moon. you know, this is the same old thing between men. I mean, who's going to be the first guy on the moon, right? Who's going to be like the first guy across the goal line? Who's going to be the first one on top of Mount Everest? Always men. For some reason, it's always men that want to do this. I wonder about women involved in this. I'm going to have some water here. I'll be the first man in the studio today at PRN to drink water. Man drinks water today. Hold on. What happened was the Russians were racing us to try to get into space. We had an astronaut program, and did you ever see The Right Stuff? Read The Right Stuff by Tom Wolfe, a great book, and also a wonderful movie. They did a really great job on this movie called The Right Stuff, which was about the development of our astronaut program and about the first men who were shot into space and orbited the Earth. This is way before they went to the moon, but the first men who orbited the Earth. And this is in the late 50s and early 60s and mid-60s. Anyhow, so but we were racing the Russians, and there was a calamitous day that happened when I was 15 years old, I think it was, in 1960. It was 59 or 60. I was 14 or 15 years old, that we were all called to the auditorium. The entire school, the entire high school I went to, Andrew Jackson High School, was called into the auditorium because the principal had some news to announce to us. And we were really, I mean, some of us were scared to death. What on earth could this possibly be? Was it finally the atomic attack that we had been fearing all these years? We didn't see any, you know, we didn't hear any sirens go off. We weren't ordered to hide in the basement of the high school so that we wouldn't, you know, suffer from atomic radiation. We were all called into the auditorium, and the teacher announced to us that Yuri Gagarin, who was a Russian astronaut, I think he was a military guy, had actually been the first man in space. The first man in space turned out not to be an American, which was only the right way to be, turned out to be a Russian, a commie. The first guy in space was a commie, and it was a disaster. For all Americans were supposed to feel scared to death and totally ashamed of themselves that the Russians beat us into space. And that was going to be the end of the space gap. That was going to be the end for all of us, because once they got into space, they were going to go to the moon, then they were going to build horrible weapons out in space, and they were going to be able to rain down death upon us from space. And they were one step ahead of us, which was astounding and surprising and overwhelming to most of America. It was a terrible, terrible thing. So, I always wondered, well, that's the point, though, too, is that it was a military race. It was a military race. From the very beginning, Of course, all these rockets were developed by people who developed them originally. These test planes were flown by men who, a lot of them, had been fighter pilots and in World War II and in Korea. They were fighter pilots, and they had moved from there into testing faster and faster jet planes to break the speed of sound and to get closer and closer to space, ultimately with the goal. And so the early rocket program and the space program was filled with the military people, and it was of great interest, obviously, to the military. So it was a military race to space. It wasn't just that typical fascination and curiosity that men have always had. And in the beginning, there were no women astronauts, and there were very few women in the space program. I always wondered whether that was just a masculine thing. I wonder still if there's many more men. I obviously are female astronauts now, and there's women in the various space programs all over the world. But I wonder if that is far more a masculine thing, to blast a rocket off, right, explode into space, so to speak, and to go wandering all over the universe, to land on the moon, Star Trek, Star Wars, to go on their 10-year mission, explore everything, get away from home, right? I'll be a little late tonight, honey. I'm not going to be home on time tonight, honey. I'm exploring Klaatu Dutu, you know. I won't be around for dinner. Maybe we can heat it up on the microwave when I get home. But is it really? I don't know what women think. I mean, if you're listening to this and you are a female, I mean, I'd be interested in your opinion. You know, you can always respond to me. The way to respond to me is by going to FederFiles, FederFiles.com after you hear this, and you know, let me know what you think. But I always thought it was a masculine thing, and maybe I still do. The idea of blasting this huge Viagra-powered missile straight into space and exploring the world and leaving behind a world, like Tom Sawyer left behind the world, of women and domestic things and children and the daily grind. Explode into space.
Looking for adventure, and whatever comes our way.
It'd be hard to find a more masculine song than that, right? Easy Rider? Did you ever see Easy Rider? The idea of getting on some giant motorcycle and heading out on the highway, same thing on the continuum of driving, you know, some huge super fast car out in the desert in some experimental place, and then, you know, flying in jets, going faster and faster and faster, then going higher and higher and higher, and then finally making it into space, and then going to setting a certain goal and going further and further and further. I guess it's a particular kind of psyche that gets involved in that kind of thing. I mean, I never did that, but, you know, I mean, I can't compare myself in that way to other people because, like I say, for reasons which I have, you know, talked about many times before, I was always scared to do everything. I mean, the fastest I ever went and the biggest chance I ever took to thrill-seeking was to go down a steep hill on my bicycle. I mean, that was about it. I was afraid of heights. I was afraid of everything. Although, when I had my car, see, that's interesting. When I had my car, when I was 19, 20, 21, in my early 20s, and I had a car, if I could get away with it on a back highway somewhere, I would put the pedal to the metal. I would go really, I would go like, you know, 90, 100 miles an hour. But it would take it out of me. And I could never, my cousin Russell, who wasn't afraid of hardly anything, was a big, strong guy. He got his own plane. He had a pretty successful business, floor waxing business. He and his brothers and his father were in, and they made a lot of money at it. They worked hard, worked like dogs all the time. Big, strong guys from the floor waxing and commercial floor waxing. He bought a small Piper Cub, a small little single engine plane, two seater. And he once took me up in the plane, and it scared the absolute crap out of me. I'm sure that a lot of you, or maybe all of you, one time or another, have been on, you know, plane flights, right? You've gone to visit people, or you've gone other places for vacations, or you've gone places for business. But and I've been on planes, too. I've been on numerous commercial jetliners, starting way back in the, actually, in the 1950s and 60s. But it was always scary to me. I never liked flying so much. There was only one thing I liked about it. I was always so, and to this day still am, one of my great flaws and defects, I was always into so being so controlling of every moment of my life for reasons. I always felt like I was in danger. More of it was like a psychological danger, not an actual danger. So I always felt and still feel like I have to control every moment of my life. Every, you know, sometimes it gets really crazy. Like every movement, my entire environment has to be controlled. I tend to be very pushy and obsessive and bossy sometimes when I'm in a position to get away with it. And one thing I liked, oddly enough, counterintuitively, one thing I liked about being in a jet plane was it was so clearly nothing I could do about it that I relaxed. Isn't that odd? I mean, it's a funny thing. Most situations I was ever in, I was able to exert some kind of control over it. I got nervous and worried, and I tried to exert control over it. But once that plane took off, that jet plane took off, and I'm strapped in the seat or sitting in the seat, what on earth can I do about it? And I felt this kind of morphine-like bliss come over me. So I actually sort of liked flying for that oddball reason. But I didn't like flying for the reason that a lot of other people liked it, and a lot of men I knew liked it. I didn't like flying because of the thrill of going through the air so fast. I mean, one time when I was about 9 years old, my father, this might have been a propeller plane. I'm not sure whether they had commercial jets back then. 1954, I went down to visit my father, who was working in Memphis. And he put me on a plane to fly back to New York City by myself, which was another whole story. And so the stewardesses were all very kind to me, and I was scared to death. I was always scared anyhow at that age, and I had reason to be. And the idea, I was up in, this is the second time I ever flew. I flew down there, and then, you know, I flew up. And I flew up by myself. There was nobody with me. When I went down there, there was nobody with me either. But when I flew up, the plane ran into a storm, a violent thunderstorm, electrical disturbances, lightning. The plane was bumping along like it was a car on a bad, pitted road. And I, everybody, grown people, they were holding on to each other. Everybody, his face was you know, like three different colors, you know, of fear and fright and worry. And people thought they were going to die. I mean, it was one of the worst plane flights I've ever been in my life. And here I am, 9 years old, already scared of everything. So the solution to this problem, according to the stewardess, was she got me up and brought me into the cabin. And they sat me, they sat me next to the co-pilot, right? You know, like right behind the co-pilot. And the pilot and the co-pilot consoled me while they were trying to negotiate this really awful storm. And they didn't seem worried. They were very professional about it. If they were worried, they didn't let on. And they were really very good about it. And it did console me. It was one of the nicest things, I think, that I remember ever happened to me. And it was, but still, to see it out the window, the only reason I could look at all that lightning and be so far up in the air like that and imagine, you know, that I'm 15,000 feet over the ground. And at one point, the plane took a real dip and went slide. It went sliding down a mudslide of air in the sky. It was just, it was terrifying. When I got home, I had nightmares for a long, long time after that, really a long time. And but it was good of them, the pilots, to do that. But still, it was one of the scariest things I've ever felt. Still, the idea of flying and flying into space is for a very particular kind of people, right? I mean, I think most of us would prefer not to do that. I'm guessing, but I would prefer, most people I know would prefer not to do it. I always wanted to have my feet on the ground. My father liked going out, like I say, on the ocean. He liked fishing. He liked to go out on boats. And if the weather was stormy or if the boat was rocking, he was having a good time. Anytime there was a little bit of danger or a little bit of trouble out in the physical world, it really turned him on. It really did. It gave him a sense of being alive. What bothered my father was routines. Doing the daily life of the daily chores of living, the daily routine, domestic life, getting up in the morning and going to work. That could be very, very boring to my father. But put him in a speeding car or a speeding plane, put him on the top of a mountain or negotiating some kind of rapid somewhere, and he woke up and he felt alive. I like to have my feet on the ground because inside, in my mind, I always feel like I am. And I feel like the world is a speeding rapids. I mean, I'm sitting in the studio right now. It's a plain old radio studio on the second floor of a small building in New York City. And, you know, it's solid, and I'm sitting here. But, you know, to me, everything can be very scary sometimes. So I like to have, I don't like to put myself in extra jeopardy. I don't like to put myself in a position where I'm in a speeding car or, you know, and like with my cousin Russell flying along. And he was flying, I think, at 125 miles an hour. And it felt like the plane was, I think, well, we needed pedals to push it. It was going so slowly. It was 125, which would have been really fast down on the ground, needless to say. But it seemed like we were just crawling along in the sky, and I felt like any second we were just going to drop out of the sky. It was just astounding, absolutely astounding. But this universality of you know, the article I read about the great dream from ancient times when people, I mean, obviously people never conceived until the 20th century, no doubt, that that they could even go into space. Nobody even thought of that. I mean, this is where the gods were, you know, this is the territory of the gods. And yet everybody, I think it's universal all over the world that people always yearned to find out where we came from. People always wanted to know who created or what created or how our world, how our planet was created. It's a universal thing. And people developed mythologies. Whole mythologies and religions were developed based on this wondering about what these stars are, why it's night, why it's day. And this idea about charging through space and investigating space. I mean, look at the success of Star Trek. Star Trek was one of the most successful programs and one of the most followed after programs, television programs there ever was. And it was an extraordinary thing. When I was a kid, I was more interested in this. I used to read, my favorite books were actually science fiction fantasy books about a man named John Carter, who was a hero in the 19th century. They're written by Edgar Rice Burroughs, by the way, who wrote Tarzan. But he wrote about this man who went to Mars. He was transported to Mars, not in a rocket ship, because this Burroughs was writing before rocket ships existed. But he was transported to Mars in some sort of magical way and wound up becoming the warlord of Mars. And it took him about a year. That's all. He was a natural fighter and a natural athlete, and he just adapted to Mars, and he had the willpower and the courage of a born fighting man, et cetera, et cetera. And I read all these books, and I read mythology when I was a kid, too. I wanted to get away from the world, too. I wanted to get away from the world, but I wanted to get away from the world because it wasn't such a good world that I lived in. My particular world was not a good world. And I dreamed all the time of going into space and going to Mars and being the warlord of Mars. And I read a ton of mythology. And mythology is also part of this. It's part of this continuum of being fascinated by the idea of exploration and the curiosity about how the world is created, why the world is the way it is. The gods originally were in Greece, were on Mount Olympus. The gods were always, obviously, had to be higher up than we were, right? God couldn't be down the block, couldn't be on our level. God to be at a higher level. God in the Bible, the Jewish and the Christian God, is everywhere, is eternal, and, you know, formed space, formed the earth, formed everything. But from, when you think of it, he formed it from a distance, right? He wasn't hanging out on the moon. God was everywhere, but he was far away. He was long ago and far away. He was far away. And the gods themselves in every culture were always high up in the world. They were high up. They were in another, if they weren't in some kind of parallel universe, they were the ones who actually created the universe, but they did it from some vast, high, far away point. And they were on mountains originally, and then finally, I think when people in the 19th century, during the era of the eruption of science, where people started to believe in science more than religion, and when people, you know, were able to eventually fly and then to fly over mountains, it seemed prosaic. The God on Mount Olympus, we just flew over Mount Olympus. Gods can't be there. They have to be higher up. They have to be somewhere else. They have to be somewhere else in the world. Wherever we can go, then God has to be much higher and further away than that. So finally you get something like Star Trek, where they're exploring space, planets, other universes, other solar systems, other universes. And was it in Star Trek? I think it was in Star Trek where they went into hyperdrive. You know, that thing that happens in Star Wars where they, what's it called? Where they just suddenly whoosh, disappear, and they're in another, they go through, through time and space at the same time. But, I watched this show. I watched Star Trek, and it was interesting, and people were fascinated by this stuff. And then there was the most famous movie was, and this came out, I think, when did this come out? In the late 60s or the early 70s? Star Wars. Not Star Wars. 2001, A Space Odyssey. When did that come out? Was it the late 60s or the early 70s? It was based on a novel by Arthur C. Clarke called Childhood's End. And it was, I remember it came out probably in the late 60s or the early 70s because it was a kind of a hallucinogenic LSD, acid trip of a movie. All kinds of special effects were used that hadn't been used before. And I never understood the story. I never really did get it. A lot of science fiction, I did not, the advanced or the theoretical science fiction, I did not understand. I mean, I just don't have the kind of mind that could grasp what people like Arthur C. Clarke were talking about. I never did even understand what the point of 2001, A Space Odyssey was. But this happened right around the same time as Men Walked on the Moon. So space was really what was happening. And everybody, do you remember, if you're old enough to remember, everybody would gather every time there was a rocket launch in the 60s or the 70s. Everybody would gather together and watch these rocket launches and to see, you know, I think there was this kind of horrible some people had this, I should say, not everybody. Some people had this terrible, what's it called? There's some German word for it. This, it's the same reason that people watch, car racing. Some people watch, the Indianapolis 500 and all these car races. There's some awful feeling down deep underneath for some people that are we having some trouble with the sound out there? No? Schadenfreude, that may be it. A Schadenfreude, right. Our resident encyclopedia there just told me that it could be Schadenfreude. Schadenfreude is a feeling that you enjoy when somebody else feels bad. And I think maybe that's what I'm talking about here. This awful, morbid, is it a desire? You know, I don't know what to call it, and it seems kind of horrible, but you want to see a crash. A lot of people, how many people, when they watch, I don't watch car racing because I can't stand, it seems ridiculous to me. I don't want to watch people racing cars. It makes me dizzy anyhow. To me, you know, aren't there better ways? I mean, we're all going to die sometime. Why speed it up so fast? But that's the kind of people, the men, who go out into the world and do this kind of thing. They take these chances. And it's good that they take these chances. It's good that they went out into space, these men. And it's good that the Wright brothers went to fly. And imagine, you know, we'd have be taking ships and covered wagons and railroad trains. And maybe it wouldn't be such a bad idea that we didn't get somewhere that was so far away in just a couple of hours, that we went thousands of miles in a couple of hours. Maybe there's still something wrong with that, but it's the same as any other scientific invention there ever was, or most, I should say. There is a good side to it, and there's a bad side to it, even military weapons. It is good that we had certain advanced military weapons in World War II, or we couldn't have encountered and defeated the Nazis or, in Europe. It was bad that we had them because they were used to kill plenty of people later on. I mean, look what happened in Vietnam. So every scientific invention, and including flight, including jet planes. Jet planes are used for what? When I say the word jet plane, what do you think of? You think of bombing. You think of bombing raids. I mean, how many American jet planes at any given time right now are in the air, launching missiles or launching or dropping bombs on people? I mean, it's just, you know, but on the other hand, how many jet planes, commercial jet flights, are there in the air at any given time? Maybe, thousands at the same time all over the earth, flying people who haven't seen each other in years and years and years, people going to get jobs in other places, people starting new lives. So there's two sides to all these things. But the one thing about these articles that I have to say finally really kind of bothered me was and is the idea that these projects are private space projects. You know how there are gated communities and federal land is being, and state land now, is being sold off. There was an article in the paper today about in Spain, millions, what's it, hundreds of thousands of acres, I guess, maybe a million acres of land that was belonged to the government of Spain, i.e. to the people of Spain, is going to be sold off because they're so broke, they need money. They figure they have about $350 million. So I guess it's tens of thousands of acres. They're going to sell it off to rich people. Is that what part of the space program is about? That everybody finally understands, and especially these rich people, they understand that the Earth is doomed. And they want to develop this program to be able to settle other planets, the moon or other planets, so that they and their families will have a place to go and leave the rest of us behind on this wretched earth that everybody has started to use as a roll of toilet paper. And the earth, you know, they talk about the tipping point. I think we've passed the tipping point now. So the earth is clearly on its way out. It's more polluted. The oceans are rising and everything. So there's this obsessive, compulsive need to develop this space program, and it's all rich people involved in it. So I don't think that the hopefulness of this writer here, who said that this could be the beginning of saving, everybody. This could be the beginning of a great exploration the same way, and a great industry like flight was, current airplanes, commercial airplanes. I don't think it's going to work out that way. I think what's going to happen is, if it does work at all, is that rich people will take off in rockets with their families after they've developed a place where they can settle on some other planet. And that will be that for the rest of us. They are definitely intending to leave us behind. Count on the 1%. You think they're going to bring us all with them? I don't think so.
She packed my bags last night, pre-flight. 0 hour, 9 a.m. And I'm gonna be high as a kite by then. I miss the earth so much. I miss my wife. It's lonely out in space on such a time. I'm less flight. And I think it's gonna be a long, long time till touchdown brings me round again to find.